Hi, this is your host, Michael Britt. Thanks to you, the Psych Files has become incredibly popular. Thousands of episodes are downloaded every day by students looking for help on their tests, professionals preparing for exams, and lifelong learners who just enjoy hearing about psychology. Now, this success is great, but it's expensive, and I really need your help to keep the podcast going. Check out the website at thepsychfiles.com and become a patron. For the price of a cup of coffee or a slice of pizza, you can keep the show going. And if you enjoy the show, it has helped you with your tests, then please lend a hand. Click on the Patreon logo on the Psych Files website. Become a patron and keep your show going and growing. Thanks so much. Hello and welcome to the Psych Files, the show in which we talk about psychology, all areas of psychology, and I'm your host, Michael Britt. And welcome to episode 185, in which we're going to take a look at two really key concepts in the area of therapy, and that's transference and countertransference. Oddly enough, I don't really talk enough about psychotherapy in the podcast, and I thought, you know, I've really got to get back, and as I know that's the topic that is of great interest to a lot of people, as me as well. I mean, I think therapy is a fascinating thing. I consider myself a big fan of the Freudian approach to psychotherapy, and I think there's a lot of really neat concepts in there. And of course, I believe that a lot of our behavior is unconsciously motivated, and we're often not aware of what makes us think and feel the way we do. So, it's time to talk about psychotherapy, in particular, a school of psychotherapy called psychoanalysis, of course, founded by Freud. A lot of these key concepts just get increasingly smaller in the textbooks, and they get shoved out by all the new stuff. But as I said in a previous episode, let's not throw Freud out with the bathwater, as they say. In other words, let's keep in mind that just because an idea is old doesn't mean it's, you know, oh, we've gone past that now. Freud had a lot of ideas. Yes, some of them, you might look at them and say, well, that I don't know if I go for that idea. All right, so they're not all great. You know, they're not all gems. But if he had lived another 100 years, I'll bet he would have changed some of his thinking. But there's two key concepts that occur during the process of psychotherapy. They occur in all types of therapy, and as you'll hear very soon, in everyday life. And those are transference and countertransference. So I was really delighted to get this book recently, and it's called Wearing My Tutu to Analysis. So it has a very memorable title, T-U-T-U, Wearing My Tutu to Analysis and Other Stories, Learning Psychodynamic Concepts from Life. So, interesting paperback book. The authors are Carrie L. Maluista, Ann Edelman, and Catherine Anderson. So let me give you a sense of the backgrounds for these three authors. I think you'll find them quite qualified to write a book on the topic. First author is Carrie Maluista. She's a PhD. She's a private practice in Potomac, Maryland, also in McLean, Virginia. She's been on the faculties of the George Washington University PhD and PsyD programs, the Smith College School for Social Work, Virginia Commonwealth University School. Along with this Wearing My Tutu to Analysis, she is also working on another book with one of her co-authors, Ann Edelman, and that's going to be called The Therapist in Mourning. And her essays have also appeared in The Washington Post, Voices, and Living with Loss. So, an active psychoanalyst and writer. Second author is Catherine Anderson. She's a psychologist and psychoanalyst in private practice in Bethesda, Maryland. A member of the Contemporary Freudian Society, an alumna of the New Directions Writing Program at the Washington Center for Psychoanalysis. Dr. Anderson's been on the faculties of University of Maryland, their PhD program, George Washington University PsyD program, and has worked in community mental health centers, forensic settings, residential programs, PTSD programs, and done a good deal of consulting as well. Ann Edelman is a clinical psychologist and a psychoanalyst with the Contemporary Freudian Society. She's also a faculty member of the New Directions Writing Program, maintains a private practice in Chevy Chase, Maryland. So we've got three, obviously, very qualified people to talk about ideas and theories from the field of psychoanalysis. So what's the book about? Well, it's a series of stories that the clients have revealed to our three authors during the course of their therapy. And the stories are interpreted from a psychoanalytic perspective. So I think if you are particularly if you're studying the area of therapy, then this is a really neat book for you to pick up. It's quite readable. Some parts are meant for people who have a little greater background in therapy, but you know, you don't have to worry about those. You can skip over those. You can really get a feeling for what goes on in therapy and what the therapist thinks from reading a book like this. So I highly recommend it. Since we're near the holidays, great holiday book. Wearing My Tutu to Analysis. And that title comes from one of the stories from the book. So we're going to discuss, myself and the lead author, Carrie Maluista, the two of the stories. Read a bunch more, and I thought, well, we just got onto these two, and I thought, you know, there's another one. We're going to do another one in the future. We talked about the one of the stories was about a patient's dream. And we talk about the dream interpretation, which is another topic that people ask about. And so I do want to do that in the future. And even though I do have a part three to my critical thinking series, I thought, nah, let's go in with this, because this is a break that up a little bit and explore something really interesting. So let's go to the interview with Carrie Maluista. Okay, so we're speaking with Carrie Maluista, and she is one of the authors, along with Ann Edelman and Catherine Anderson, of a very interesting new book that I have been reading and enjoying called Wearing My Tutu to Analysis and Other Stories. So I've got a couple of the stories I'd love to talk to you about, but maybe first I'd just like to ask, what made you decide time to write a book?
Well, I was in a program called New Directions in Writing, which is a program that joins writing and psychotherapy. And it was a fascinating program. It's a 3-year program. And it was there that I started to write creatively and also professional material. And it was at the end of my 3 years of that program that I had one of those aha moments where I suddenly realized a lot of my stories described very well psychodynamic concepts. So it was at that weekend that I turned to my colleagues who were also students in this program, Ann Edelman and Catherine Anderson, and said, you know, what do you think of this idea? And they were very excited. So we started off together, and it was a wonderful journey and process because, you know, we had to figure out how to work as a, you know, a unit. And by the end, we felt like we had one voice and we really enjoyed doing this. So that's why we don't even identify who the stories are. We each wrote some of our own, and then we'd meet together every week and spend several hours working on them and editing together.
So what school was that offered that program?
It's through the Washington Psychoanalytic in Washington, D.C., and it's its own program. It's 3 years, and you go for 3 weekends over those 3 years. So for anybody interested in improving your writing but interested in psychodynamic ideas, it's truly a wonderful program. There have been so many people who've written books from it who never wrote before. It really is inspiring. So that's what got us started.
Well, you know, apart from the fact that I want to do more episodes on psychotherapy, even though I often begin each episode saying, hey, it's what psychology is really all about. I want people to learn that psychology is about a bunch of different things. But of course, you know, psychotherapy is fascinating. One of the subtitles here is Learning Psychodynamic Concepts from Life, which is kind of a subtitle that got to me as well. So it's neat that you were able to draw from the therapeutic sessions and also talk about when we get to the story about the woman who had the dream. You show how the dream components came from an experience that she had had that day. It's a fascinating book. There's a lot in here, not just for, you know, there's a lot of different levels here. If you're a professional psychotherapist, you'll read a lot and say, oh yeah, I remember learning about that. Mm-hmm. If you're new to it, then some of those concepts might be a bit above you, but I wouldn't worry about it. You'll find out how therapy really works. So it's a really neat book.
Thank you. Yeah, we wanted something also that we thought, right, people not in the field might be sparked and interested by. But for new students in the field, they can get so anxious sometimes when they read these very technical articles and it make it sound so pathologizing of everything. We thought if we could use just everyday stories to show how normal these events are really and how they happen, they're ubiquitous to our lives.
Yeah, I know there's this huge disconnect between what you might learn about Freud and psychoanalysis, which is simplistic and unfortunately focuses far too heavily on sex. So I guess that makes it interesting to talk about and to joke about, but we get a very poor picture of what psychoanalysis is all about, and treating psychoanalysis as if it was World War I.
Exactly.
It's over, we're past that.
Right, yeah.
Freud was all about sex and other kinds of weird ideas, and we're way past that now. And nobody, were, you know, that stuff's only practiced by, you know, people who are interested in voodoo or something like that.
Right.
You know, it's so painful to hear because the ideas, once you get into them, are just absolutely fascinating. I want you to, the audience will get that feeling through what you have to say. So if you want to jump into the story number 6, wearing my 222 analysis.
Sure. Well, the story is the writer talking about her experience of being in analysis herself and her running up against an event where she has to go to her father, who is receiving a ward at a Friday night right after her analytic session. And she spends many weeks worried about how does she get dressed up appropriately for this fancy event, but still go to analysis. This is a woman which clearly part of the work had been around somewhat an idealizing and adoration of her father from childhood and memories of being a child and dressing up for her father and being told, oh, don't you look so pretty. And then when this meets with what we would call the transference in terms of her male analyst, where she then is in a position where she might have to dress up for him, it's both the longing and the fear and anxiety that leads to what the story describes is her somewhat unconscious actually making it come true. She comes up with the resolution that she will change after her session and then not have to show her analyst her dress. So she leaves her session, goes out, uses the restroom and changes, and then goes back to her car and realizes she locked her keys in the car. So needing then to return to her analyst, knock on the door, to use the telephone in order to get help, you know, to get into her car. So it's sort of a simple story. It could happen to anyone.
Yes, yeah, what I thought was interesting is that here we have a setting, a client and a therapist, and this is actually a positive thing, right? This client, because the next story, which is about, you know, joining the pain, is about someone who was abused. But this one is so we've got a client who had a very positive relationship with her father.
Right. It was a good one, but had its own complications in some ways because of how positive it was. And some of that's, you know, some of the conflict of moving on to finding a man who could be as good as her father and just all those complications. I mean, that wasn't her reason for being in treatment, but one factor was the influence of the relationship with her father. And this made it get enacted in real life moments in this having to get dressed up for this event.
Yeah, so she's in this unique situation where the father's going to receive a ward. The ceremony is just shortly after her session. She doesn't want to cancel the session, but she doesn't want to go to the session dressed in really. Well, she's not dressed in a tutu, though, right?
No, I mean it was a play on the word because as a child she did some ballet.
So she's in this dilemma of how do I get dressed for this event but go to therapy? So she decides to bring the dress with her, put it in the car, and then after therapy, she'll just say, you know, goodnight or whatever, and then go out, get the dress, sneak back in, go into the bathroom, get changed, and then leave.
Right.
But she leaves, what she realizes is she unconsciously leaves the keys in the car, which results in her having to go back and talk to the therapist about getting a locksmith. And of course, the therapist will then see her all dressed up in this outfit.
Exactly.
Okay, so your interpretation then of this.
Well, we use that story to teach and explain the idea of transference. And basically, transference is when we take real-life feelings from our own life and then literally transfer them onto the therapist or analyst. But basically, we do this in all aspects of our lives. If the brain had to respond to every new encounter like they've never seen it before, we'd be overwhelmed with data. So in a sense, transference is our way of using what we've learned from our earlier lives, and then we represent it on new people who come along. And sometimes that's for positive, you know, when things have been gone well, or sometimes negatively, when we keep repeating relationships that weren't helpful.
So does this happen, for example, if you're watching a television show, maybe particularly a soap opera or something like that, but those are actors, and it's always weird when we see them in their normal, you know, habitat and being interviewed, because they're not at all, you know, they might have a totally different accent, but they're not at all like we thought they were. So do we do that all the time then?
Yeah, we have transferences all the time to both famous people and people in our private lives. When we meet people, we quickly take in all the data, sometimes too quickly, and make assumptions. And then we somewhat react to that person as if we know who they are. And again, sometimes leading to problematic responses and sometimes more positive ones. But we all have transferences to what we imagine the other person is like.
So in this situation, it's very easy to see how a transference could develop. The client begins to think of the male therapist as like her father.
Right. He's an older man and kindly and in many ways, somewhat even in reality, like the father, but in other ways, of course, not. And there's where the transference comes in. It's almost like we have preordained scripts, in a sense, of how we play out our relationships in life.
So you're saying that she left the keys in the car unconsciously because what she really wanted, she was avoiding having the therapist see her in this dress. But actually, there's part of her that did want him to see her in this dress.
Exactly. And in the wonderful way the unconscious works, it still showed itself. So that's what's so wonderful about therapy and analysis. It gives you moments to see the power of the unconscious, and things that we're not expecting to do, we do.
So what are you saying that she, what did her unconscious want from the therapist by being seen in this dress?
Well, was this father transference that he would look at her with the same eyes her father did and admire her and say, "Don't you look pretty?" Which this analyst had a playful side. And so when the author returned, the analyst actually opened the door, smiled because he recognized what happened. And he said, "My, what a pretty party dress." So in that moment, he both in somewhat was interpreting, I mean, because the patient was aware, they were both aware in that moment of what had happened. And rather than put it into technical words, he sort of used the words that the patient had used about her father. "My, what a pretty party dress."
So she wanted his approval.
Yes. So it's somewhat transferring the past onto the present.
She wanted him to be like a father to her.
Right. And to have that same love from him that a father would have, which most patients want with their therapist, if they admit it or not, is some feeling of that kind of love response from the therapist.
Right. It's so easy to think of the therapist as a parent.
Yes.
It's ripe for that.
Right. It doesn't just come from the past, though. I mean, it is infused by the current day fantasies, too, and unconscious. So it's not like we literally transpose our childhood father onto this one. Of course, it's overlaid with everything that happens in between and our experiences.
Well, let me ask you this. After I finished this, one of my thoughts was, what happened was that she forgot and she left her keys in the car.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me just be the devil's advocate here, because the thing that people worry about in terms of psychology is a psychologist, "Oh, you're always analyzing everything I'm doing," right?
Right.
You've heard that, I'm sure, more than enough times, so have I. And someone could say after reading this, "Look, she left her keys in the car. Can we not make a big deal out of this?"
Right. And there's certainly times people would leave their keys in the car and it wouldn't mean anything. So I'm of the mind, yeah, that we don't too quickly make everything, as Freud said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. But this encounter was something that had followed several weeks of a lot of feeling about this event and the wish to show it, not to show it. So it was hard for both therapist and patient not to see how this happened.
That this particular event did have meaning.
That's right. There might be other times a patient locks their keys in the car. We might say nothing about it. You know, even if it had unconscious meaning, who would know? And there's nothing there about it. And I think sometimes therapists can make their patients just anxious and uncomfortable. That looks like every little movement they do is going to be scrutinized. So I would not want to give that idea that that's what a therapist is doing. But in this encounter, the patient herself was very aware of the wish. And when it happened, even leaving the keys in the car, she described feeling so aware of what she had set up.
And the other thing I like to tell people is that really all of us are trying to figure out what the other person is doing.
You know? Right.
It's
right.
Not like therapists are unusual in that respect.
That's right. There's two people in the room, and that's where it gets into the whole idea of what's called enactment, too, is that, you know, in the old days, therapy was almost viewed as a one-person psychology. It was the therapist sitting on high knowing what's going on for the patient, and they're sort of not part of it. And nowadays, most would agree that it's an interaction, and there's two people influencing each other. And sometimes the therapist is drawn in, and sometimes the patient, and these things come alive in the room, which is where the power of therapy happens, in a sense, when those moments are alive between the therapist and patient.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Okay, so now that, in an unplanned way, is a wonderful segue into story number 17, called Joining the Pain.
Yes.
Now, this was one of the heavier ones, because this has a lot to do with countertransference.
And yes.
I think that's a fascinating concept. We've got therapist and the patient in this case, very different situation. We have a young girl, and I'll read a little bit from your book here. Unwashed adolescent girl, thick hair is lank and needs to be washed. She smells. I mean, you know, you've got some of her clothes are mismatched. In reading this story, you can just picture this kind of adolescent who projects a certain amount of, I don't like the world, you know, kind of thing, and how easy it would be to react, particularly when someone smells, and react in a kind of like, but she's got some serious issues here. Quote, the pediatrician who treats her thinks that she sometimes cuts herself perhaps hundreds of times a day, and that there are thousands of scars on her body.
Yeah. And even hearing those words, how painful it is to hear. And then for this particular therapist writing about what it's like to sit with someone and hear that kind of pain and what they're doing to their body. So in this, we do look at countertransference, but it's important to realize, you know, this is an extreme case, but that again, just like transference, countertransference, just like its name, is ubiquitous everywhere too. It's the therapist, all the emotional responses a therapist has to a patient, both conscious and unconscious, and how valuable that data is if it can be used in the right way. And that's where the skills of the therapist come in, where they can make note of the feelings they're having and the reactions and use it to further the work and maybe understand how the patient is actually feeling. An example of that is when a patient comes in and describes something horrific happening in their life, and they are telling it like nothing happened, and the therapist is suddenly overwhelmed with feeling. You know, how much that tells us a bit about what's happening with the patient, what they are trying not to feel, why we are perceiving it and feeling it ourselves. So countertransference goes on, you know, even in the case wearing my tutu, I'm sure the analyst in that story had his own countertransference, even though it's a lighter, more, you know, amusing and poignant story, the analyst would have their own reactions. Mm-hmm. And the more easier ones sometimes are towards the loving patient, like in wearing my tutu. And in this story, the author has to deal with sometimes the feeling of repulsion and wanting to push the other away when something feels so horrific.
So we've got this patient disheveled, even smelly, and have cuts on her body. Now, the people around her, even family, might say hurtful things like, you know, can't you even get dressed right? Look at the way you can hear parents. Look at this, look at that. Even the friends might criticize her. So she's alienating herself from everyone.
Right.
I could see her coming to a sort of a cognitively oriented, or perhaps behaviorally oriented. Yeah, you know, I'm not criticizing them, but you know, you might come to a therapist who would take a look at you and say, "Okay, we need to work on your daily hygiene. We'll create some goals," and you know, okay, so that is a way to approach a patient like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
But another therapist might have this patient. She comes in, she sits down, she smells, blah blah, blah, and the therapist would feel like, God, this person's disgusting, or sympathy, like, oh my God, this is so terrible. That's
sure,
you know, or feel like, oh, I wish I didn't have a patient like this. But what you're saying is that the power of these feelings that the therapist has, be it disgust or empathy, is that the therapist is able to say to themselves, okay, now right now, obviously they're not going to say this out loud, or you're not going to go this way, but it's going to be like, I feel a sense of disgust. I feel a sense of loathing, and I don't want to be around this person. And they use that as, now, what does that mean? Why does the patient want me to feel that way?
Right. Exactly. And then put it into words. So first, you need the experience of what they, in the field, they'd call containing it, meaning being able to tolerate the feeling. Because we can even subtly look like we're doing the work by being intellectual, though. We could say to a patient, well, I wonder why you would treat yourself so badly. And even though we sound like we're being a therapist there, the interaction still would be getting across the criticism, the pejorative, and we're under the cloaks of being, you know, caretaking. Mm-hmm. So I think containing it means being able to tolerate the feelings. And then sometimes in the field, they use the word metabolize it, meaning, you know, be able to work with it enough to give it back to the patient in a way that they can hear it. Last week, I had a patient walk in, had never seen me before, sat down and started screaming at me, you know, in a very hostile way. And of course, like anyone, it takes you aback, and you could at first want to get defensive or say, well, why are you so hostile, which would only increase it. And at that moment, what I had to do was sort of contain it and then put myself literally in her feeling and imagine, why would someone come in and be telling me this? And very softly, I said to her, it must feel so humiliating to come in and tell a therapist all these awful feelings. And she stopped, started to cry, and we were off and having a real communication. But if I would have operated out of the initial countertransference of, whoa, what is this hostile woman doing here? I probably wouldn't have seen her again. So I don't know if that captured it, but it was using feeling, but trying to imagine why this person is showing me this now, and what does this mean?
Fascinating. I love that example you just gave. If someone like this young girl arrives and sits down, and so you're not going to react by saying, look at the way you cut yourself, you know, nothing parental, nothing
right.
Pejorative. What might you say? Because that person might be, that young woman might be so angry, she's just, I'm just going to sit here and not say anything. She's just going to fold her arms because she's angry. She's angry.
Right. Well, I think that's why a lot of times people who physically show their pain, like in cutting or severe restricting food, is that they've never had access to really what they're feeling and how to put it into words. So I think the beginning with a patient like that would be even just letting them know you could sit and tolerate them not knowing, in a sense. And it does take a long time. That's why I think, as opposed to more of a cognitive approach, which says, okay, we're going to go in and change the way you're thinking, it really sort of says that this person is going to need some time to even tolerate the feelings to the smallest degree. And that gradually my job would be to help them learn to put into words and for them to be able to contain the feelings so that they don't need to do it by cutting. So I think it starts with the therapist being able to contain it so that then we can help the patient begin to contain these overwhelming traumatic feelings and experiences.
So I'm not going to express any of my disgust. I'm going to use it as information that will help me to help her explore where her life is at and why she's dressing the way she is.
Right.
Such a subtle thing.
Yeah.
When you read this, it's the other thing that comes to mind is just that public mental health is moving so much in the direction of the goal setting and all that. And maybe that would help her. I mean, you know, you can't.
Right.
The only way I can imagine you getting to some of the core issues of this young woman has is to have a lot of time, you know, not a short session. And,
right.
You know, not the maybe 25 sessions. And by the way, we're done because your insurance ran out.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, this has been such a long time existing, these kind of problems, right, that someone's not going to quickly unload all this background. The experience that led to the brain operating in this way has taken over and over experiences, and the brain needs repeated experiences of working through it in another form. And I don't think that happens in just a few or even 20 visits.
So if I may, I'd like to quote from this session as an example of the kind of work that lies ahead for a young person like this. Over time, she, that's the meaning that the client, haltingly explains that as terrifying as it is to continue her slow, steady self-annihilation, you know, her cutting, It is equally terrifying to imagine stopping. She will tell me later what she fears most. If she quits cutting, she will be alone. Cutting has soothed her for years, warding off her overwhelming emptiness and terror. She's convinced that if she stops, if she gets healthy, she will lose everyone who matters. Mm-hmm. I mean,
And
you can, reading that, I thought, you know what, I think I can understand.
Yeah, and that's the feeling the therapist you want to get to with the patient is like where you can both get to, wow, you both together understand this now. And that's what's so exciting about doing therapy is that when we don't have presuppositions about what these meanings are, but when we really come to them together with the patient and realize what looked like one behavior that made no sense, when you really dig deeper, it came out of a good reason in a sense, but it just doesn't work anymore. And that might surprise you what's behind it.
Yeah. I mean, a person like this has a long way to go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the nice thing is she came into treatment young enough where she can have the time to do that and live a different life.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Carrie. I thought that was such a good introduction to those key concepts. So before I go, just want to let you know again about my apps that are out there, Psych Explorer. If you want all the news in psychology, all the latest really credible information about what's going on in the field, then this is it, Psych Explorer, P-S-Y-C, Explorer. If you go into iTunes, you'll find it in there. That's an iOS app only, unfortunately, for now. So that's iPhone and for the iPad as well. So you get news, videos, audio. It's got all kinds of great information in there about the field of psychology. So if you want to keep up with the latest, that's the app. If you're a student of psychology, you want to find out what's going on in the field, you're not sure which area you want to focus on, Psych Explorer is for you, as is Psych Test Hero, which is my iPad and Android tablet app, Psych Test Hero. And it is a test preparation app, so it will help you get ready for your tests. And on the smartphones, both the iPhone and the Android, it's called simply Psych Hero. And once again, a reminder about the Patreon campaign. If you enjoy the show or it has helped you on your exams, please help me to keep it going. A small donation per month will keep the Psych Files going, and we can do more. So give just a little bit and become a part of the show. Thanks.